Welcome to the CDC Insight Podcast. CDC is the UK's development finance institution and impact investor. And in this episode, we're sharing some of the highlights from one of our recent Insight events. These events share practical lessons on private sector investment and development based on our experiences, knowledge, and research. Now, this particular event focused on how we can tackle the climate crisis in a just and inclusive way. With the world's most vulnerable people taking the brunt of the effects of global warming, it's important for us to consider how we can solve our generation's biggest challenge without impacting the populations least responsible for it. Our guests today are the environmental scientist, Dr. Tara Shine, and CDC's Managing Director and Head of Infrastructure, Holger Rothenbusch. They were both speaking with your host, CDC's General Counsel and Head of External Relations, Colin Buckley.
The climate crisis has been called the challenge of our generation, and its potential impacts almost defy calculation. In addition to being pernicious, however, climate change is also inequitable. Harm will fall disproportionately on the poor, on women, on the dispossessed. As if solving climate problems was not complex enough, we must also ensure that the solutions address those inequities. I'm joined today by Dr. Tara Shine to explore how we can deal with the climate crisis in a just manner. Dr. Shine is an environmental scientist and director at Change by Degrees, an environmental consultancy. She's also the chair of the International Institute for Environment and Development. Dr. Shine has a wealth of experience as an international climate change negotiator and advisor to world leaders on environmental and climate policy and on climate justice. She was recently appointed by the United Nations to oversee the next international review of the global climate goals. And her first book, How to Save Your Planet, One Object at a Time, was published earlier this year. So welcome, Tara.
Thank you so much, Colin.
Can we speak a little bit about climate justice? Because you're a passionate campaigner on the topic of climate justice. Here at CDC, our natural markets are developing countries. So I'm wondering if you could help us kind of put those together. And what does climate justice mean for developing countries, where the ones that we partner with?
Yeah, so the best way to understand climate justice is to start off with what's unjust about it. So if you talk to your kids, even if they're 3 or 4 years old, those of you who have kids, they understand what is fair and unfair from a very young age. So this is something we all understand. And so I was just trying to explain some of this in a lecture for young people with the Royal Institution in London last week. And when you understand that the people that are most affected by the impacts of climate change right now are the people who contributed least to the problem, it is clear that that's unfair. So the people that don't drive around in an SUV, that don't own a fancy house, they may not even have electricity in their home, that have never been on an aeroplane, their emissions are zero. They suffer the worst impacts of climate change. That to me is, to anybody, is fundamentally unfair. And so climate justice accepts that that's unfair and tries to find ways to put that right. Climate justice is very much a people-centered approach to dealing with climate change, climate action, and sustainable development. It is embedded in human rights. So obviously, climate impacts undermine people's human rights, their rights to food, to water, to shelter. But climate action can also, if not done correctly, also undermine human rights. If we make poor decisions about where we make investments in renewable energy, for example, we can undermine the rights of the communities that live in those areas. If we don't look to share the benefits of climate action, whether that is cleaner air, cheaper fuel, safer ways to get around, if we don't share those benefits equitably, then we only create further inequality in the world. And what we've seen from COVID, and we know from many aspects of looking at what causes and sustains poverty around the world, is when those people who are vulnerable whatever the crisis is, whether it is COVID or it is climate. And so climate justice is really about putting people at the center and making sure that we stop and check that nobody is unfairly burdened by the impacts of climate change or the responses to climate change. So we can't just create responses to climate change that are good for us in the developed world. They have to be good for everybody. We have to enable every country and every community to make the transition to a zero carbon sustainable future together. We can't leave some countries behind with dirty industry and dirty air. We have to bring everybody. And that is in our collective self-interest, because we can't keep warming to below 1.5 degrees if every country in the world isn't part of the effort. So climate justice helps us to kind of mobilize that solidarity and to see that it is obviously, as we all know, a global commons problem, but it's a question, its answers lie in finding solutions that benefit all. And that don't unfairly burden any one part of society. And that applies equally in developed and developing countries. In developed countries, we probably talk about it in terms of just transition. So how do we make the transition from a fossil fuel-based economy to a clean economy without some of our workers being unfairly burdened or any unfair impacts on one part of the community. But obviously it applies on this wider scale too, in that, you know, if we look at small island states or least developed countries, as I say, they're responsible for very few emissions, yet their development prospects are eroded day after day by the impacts of climate change.
Yeah, I see the relative burden inequities and also the political dynamics that kind of leads to. And a lot of your job has been trying to negotiate between countries taking on mm-hmm. their fair burden. I mean, for CDC, we principally invest and partner with private sector businesses in, for the large part, the sort of the victimized countries, mm-hmm. the ones that are a little bit behind the development curve. So what is it that we can do beyond just helping our companies think about climate risk to add on this sort of the filter of climate justice? How can we bring that to our businesses?
Well, first of all, I would say keep at it with the climate risk. Look at coincident risks. Look at the risks of investing. Look at the risks of not investing. Look at who benefits from your investment. Does it actually flow down and have an impact at the local level? Does it benefit women and men equitably? Who benefits and who's disadvantaged by the investments that you make? You know, there are any number. If you look at the guideline, the human rights and business guidelines, they give you a really good orientation on top of just checking with your ESG guidelines what you're doing. You know, check against the human rights as well and make sure that what you're doing is protecting people all the way too. It's also to get away from a sense of let's just do no harm to really seeing are we doing good and making sure that every single investment is good for the planet and is good for people and that you're absolutely robust on that. Because we are not yet at the point where we are adhering enough to, you know, the third part of the objective of the Paris Agreement, which is to ensure that all financial flows are consistent with the temperature goals set out in the agreement. And so, you know, we shouldn't be investing any money from this point forward that isn't contributing to the SDGs directly and that isn't contributing to a net zero world by 2050.
Yeah, I mean, you played a pivotal role in the Paris negotiations, and it was a moment of great world focus and thinking back on it, optimism around climate change. But I was struck, you mentioned earlier, you know, the direction of travel. And I think that we need to be cutting fossil fuels production by about 6% a year until 2030 to stay on track. And as you identified, in fact, fossil fuels production continues to increase at about 2%. So we're kind of going backwards. I mean, where are we on you know, the Paris Agreement? And you know, are we going backwards? Is there still a route forwards? Can you give us some sense of that kind of broader movement?
Yeah, so the direction of travel set by Paris has been influential. That's why I think we see these commitments from countries, cities, states, and large organizations around setting net zero by 2050 goals. So the direction of travel part of Paris has been very effective. I think it remains to be seen now at COP26 if the ratchet up mechanism, so nationally determined contributions that are then increased every 5 years, it remains to be seen whether we see enough increase in those commitments next year to say whether that's being effective in actually helping us to achieve the temperature goal. Because right now we're on track to 3 degrees or more of warming. So that needs to improve.
If you can take out your crystal ball, COP26 will be in the UK sort of next year. I mean, what do you have any thoughts? What might be the headline or the paradigm shift that might come out of COP26?
So my dream headline would be that countries of the world come to the table with commitments that will keep us safe and will keep warming to 1.5. That would be my dream headline. In terms of things that I'd like to see emerge from the COP, I think I would really like this COP to, as I spoke about, give leadership. So I would like it to have this bigger picture around how the countries are going to collaborate to solve these problems. I would like the decisions that are taken to be very much informed by science. So the role I'm playing at the moment with the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change is around a science policy dialogue and making sure that policymakers have time to stop and pause while not negotiating, to be informed by and learn about the latest science and how that science has filled gaps in knowledge that we had in 2015. So for example, in 2015, we understood very little about the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees. We understand so much more about that now. So that has to inform the decisions that policymakers take. So I hope that the science informs the decision-making and that we have space for that. And then I hope that this COP can be really, truly inclusive. And I mean that the voices of the most vulnerable countries are heard at the negotiating table, but also that the COP reaches a wider community, that it reaches the communities around it in Glasgow, and that they feel part of it, that they know what it is and know why it's important that their city is hosting it. But likewise, that spreads across the rest of the UK, and that we can use these new ways of interacting and communicating online to ensure that what a COP is more widely understood and more widely accessible to more people. That forces us to be more transparent and more accountable in how the negotiations are run. It forces us to stop speaking in mumbo jumbo jargon that nobody else can understand. It forces us to be clear in why decisions are being taken and how. So improving the participation in the COP, helping it to land down from that kind of being a spaceship floating above the earth, as it sometimes is, into something that is embedded in the reality of everyday lives, so that people understand its role and why it's important to them. That would be another thing I would really like to come from COP26.
Well, that gives us some realistic goals to aim for, so thank you. Let me widen this out now and introduce Holger Rothenbusch, who is Managing Director and Head of the Infrastructure and Climate Change Team here at CDC Group. So let me start out, Holger. I mean, Tara has outlined a number of actions that the private sector can take to help meet the climate challenge. And I was wondering, based on your experience in the industry and in commercial banks, how do we get private businesses and financial institutions to commit to meaningful action on climate change?
Well, I think it's not a mystery that in particular commercial banks, but private investors in many instances are not necessarily sort of at the forefront of developments or are very innovative. They are mainly, you know, focused on maximizing profits, which is what companies do. So I think obviously this is a discussion that has been around for a long time. And when you look at what initially sort of started out were international standards having been established, like the Equator Principles, which have been around for quite a number of years. And that certainly over time, you know, increasingly led to improved environmental and social standards being applied by the banking industry and by the private sector investors in general. And clearly, those standards are being tightened. And at the moment, many on the call will know about the TCFD initiative that was started by the ex-governor of the Bank of England, the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, which again, I think is the next standard that is being introduced by many institutions, which will focus on risk management related to climate. And that again, I think is the next step in pushing providers of capital into the right direction. Clearly there are sort of other avenues which we are increasingly seeing, and that has also been there for a while, which are sort of investor activism, where shareholders of banks are exerting pressure, where we are increasingly seeing interest of investors to invest in green funds, for example, that ultimately created an incentive for managers of funds, for example, or then also green banks to start invest more into climate-friendly investments. So I think those are all very positive effects that one would have observed over the last years. What I certainly see right now is, I think ultimately, in my view, what will really make a bigger difference to this, which is that very much driven by change of technology, which is focusing on the renewables like solar and wind. You know, those technologies for the longest time were very difficult to implement in an economic fashion. Nowadays, you know, solar power is cheaper than most thermal power plants, and that is a very strong economic argument. And just on the back of this, the market rationale is really shifting towards investments in renewable energy. And when you look at the statistics in 2019, the vast majority of new additional power that was created around the world was renewable energy. This is really happening, and that is not because of any standards or principles, rather than it just makes good business sense, which is a very fortunate confluence of factors coming together, because that is ultimately what will move the markets.
Thanks, Holger. And Tara, we spoke about what private businesses could do in the context of climate justice, but what can banks and investors do around inclusion and climate justice? And to make it a little bit more direct, what is it that they should do more of, and what is it potentially that they should stop doing in order to promote climate justice?
Thank you, Colin. Yeah, so I think a key thing is that even with investors that are very well briefed on ESG, I still think we're separating environment and social far too much. I still don't think we actually understand how the two things are linked and how they go hand in hand. And we need to break them out of their silos and show that they're one in the same thing, when really what we're striving to do is to make a better society with good returns, obviously, on investments and improve people's lives. So there's still not enough finance and investment getting to the local level in the developing economies that you're, for example, in CDC investing in. It's not getting down to the bottom. How are you measuring that? Where does the flow of your investment end? Is it just benefiting sort of at the level of the capital city? Is it actually getting out into the regions? Is it really getting down and changing people's lives? How much of that is actually ending up benefiting women? Do you know? If you don't know, can you find out? Because I think this is the key thing. You know, money gets to a certain point and then it gets stuck. How much of it is actually getting out through either decentralized systems or effective healthcare systems, education systems, out to where really it's needed. So I think that's something we need to ask ourselves a lot more about. IIED did some research in 2016 and found that only 10% of international climate finance was making it to the local level. So where is it stuck, and why is it stuck? Research that was done by the OECD just after the Paris Climate COP found also that not enough spending on climate action from bilateral aid, for example, that was what they looked at, that not enough of that climate finance was actually having a gender dimension to it. And that very, very little of that climate finance was actually going to support women's civil society or community-led organizations. So there is a constant struggle to get funding into the hands of the change makers at the local level. Many of those change makers are women. They may not have the right connections to be connected with the right people to get at this money. You may have to create more innovative ways of dispersing that money. You may have to throw the whole thing up in the air and look at it differently. But if you don't stop and ask, where is the money going? Who is benefiting? Who isn't benefiting? You're never going to know. And I would challenge that to all investors, to actually know right to the end of the line who's benefiting from the investment. And you also asked me, sorry, Colin, what not to do. well, don't just keep throwing money into holes if you don't know, if you don't know where it's going and if you don't know what it's changing. And if you can't show how it is A, creating a return, B, improving people's lives, and that you're certain that you're not making their lives worse, and C, not just avoiding harm in the environment, but actually doing something beneficial to the environment, then stop doing it.
So thank you very much for listening to this podcast. You can subscribe to this show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you want to stay up to date with our latest news, you can find us on LinkedIn and Twitter. We'll be back with another episode of the podcast in a couple of weeks. See you then.